Thanks, Rob, for a very informative talk. Okay, what we'll do is have questions from the floor now, and Rob will answer them in turn, and then that'll open up for a wider discussion, perhaps. Frank.
You know, what happened to the communist part of Israel? I mean, at one time, a more quieter period, it attracted both Arab and Jewish members. You know, as
far as
it has actually folded up, but do you know anything about it, Rob?
Yeah, to my knowledge, Frank, that's actually not the case. There were separate communist parties for Israel and for Palestine. Basically, I'll tell you what's happened. The Communist Party of Palestine still exists. It's part of the PLO. The PLO is basically set up as a sort of kind of popular front organisation. So within it, you've got Fatah, which is the main part of the PLO, the main secular part of the PLO, which Arafat set up and helped lead. You've got the Communist Party, various groups. I mean, they call it, gets very Monty Python. There's the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the splitters are sitting over there, sort of thing. It's about, you know, eight guys in a Kalashnikov somewhere in Tulkarm, basically, but they all back the PLO. As for the Israeli Communist Party, to be honest, mate, I don't know. I guess it's folded. I mean, unless anyone tells me different, I'm sure there still probably are Stalinist groups within there. What I would imagine is they probably folded to within the kind of Israeli left-wing movement. There's a party called like Mapam, which is a left-wing split-off from the Israeli Labour Party, which is essentially Benite leftists. There's the Peace Now movement. I mean, I should imagine a lot of these people are probably former CPers. The Communist Party of Israel took a real hammering after 67. I know that because it actually backed an Arab victory during the Six Days War. Not the best tactic if you're trying to, you know, get Israeli recruits, one would have to say. Not the brightest kind of response. A lot of people I knew when I lived in Israel, old people who were in the Israeli Communist Party, sort of 67 was a bit like their version of the secret speech, really. You know, in 54, that's when a lot of them left. So I don't know. I should imagine it doesn't exist anymore. Or maybe there's a little rump group that does exist, but like I said, they've probably folded into the wider kind of Israeli left would be my best guess. Speak when the spirit moves you, as we're in a quiet building.
On that last point, wouldn't the Israeli Communist Party mainly composed of Israeli Arabs? So,
I don't know, Adam, to be honest. Maybe it was. I mean, I know there's an organisation called the Arab Democratic Party, which is the more sort of liberal, lefty liberal group that represents a lot of Arab Palestinians, Arab and Christian Israelis. But to be honest, I don't know. Without getting on the net and doing a bit more research about it, I wouldn't know, to be honest. Like I say, there are various like Israeli Trotskyist groups nowadays, but if anybody knows any more than me, great. Please share it with us. There's an interesting, I mean, that is an interesting group within Israel, non-Jewish Israelis. There aren't many of them. There's like probably only about 30 or 40,000 of them. Basically, as some of you may know, a lot of them actually took part during the initial violence during the present intifada, which on the whole they didn't during the first intifada between 87 and 93. This is because they're in real kind of dire economic and social straits as well. Basically, they tend to be concentrated around the area of Galilee, the north of Israel, and up towards the Golan Heights. Increasingly, they're also being dispossessed by new settlers and groups that are coming into Israel. For example, a lot of groups that came from East Africa, from Ethiopia and Eritrea, have been settled in exactly these same areas. If you've ever been up there as well, they're pretty barren. You know, again, a lot of the water from up there, the main resource, is being shipped out into the rest of Israel, being piped out. It's a pretty barren, desperate place where you've got to try and scratch a living. And a lot of these people, you know, just tend to do casualised factory and agricultural labour within Israel. So, I mean, they're in a pretty dire sort of situation as well. And, of course, they're being, as Israeli governments get more right-wing and more reactionary, they're being excluded from any kind of settlement and being discriminated against as well. It's interesting to note the amount of racism that goes on within Israeli society. and the sort of the divisions between various groups within Israel proper itself, depending on where you're descended from originally, etc., and so forth. I lived in Israel in 1990. And back then there were scandals about the way that a lot of African Jews from Eastern Africa were being treated. It was pretty appalling, pretty colonial, really. You know, language and policy reminiscent of the 40s and 50s rather than the 90s. So, yeah.
Jerry?
Okay, just a few thoughts come to me. It seems I find it hard to imagine any kind of truly revolutionary movement arising from the circumstances in those countries. Just because, you know, a truly revolutionary solidarity, as you said, is an international, so it's got to have that kind of consent.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, if it's capitalism is the problem, and that's why everyone is sort of kind of imprisoned within their own little exploitative.
Sure, but I mean, the reality of it also is that there are quite porous gaps in there. Israel needs a lot of cheap labour. It relies on a lot of Palestinians to do that. Whenever there is problems and they shut down the territories, that's starving sort of people out and cutting them off from what meagre kind of wages they do get. But I don't think I put it too well, that end bit. I think I've done it better in I did a branch discussion meeting on this a couple of months ago. If you start to get a response across the whole Middle East through conditions dictating that there can be, not only more proletarianisation, but people actually acting as workers rather than as a national group, then it does definitely have the potential to ignite and get wider. Like I was saying, living standards in the area across the board for Israelis and Palestinians are getting much, much worse. They're, on average, they're falling. You know, like a lot of countries, Israel was one of those countries beforehand in the 60s and 70s and whatever that was right up there with Sweden and New Zealand as a very, very high average standard of living. And, now that's for Israelis, but that's plummeting now. And so you're going to get a lot more, class conflict and discontent actually within Israel itself proper. And there is a history of it. There is a history, particularly amongst, the Ashkenazi European descended Israelis, of being, not members of the SPGB, but being quite left wing in one way or another. And now maybe they'll break out of that old sort of, Zionist sort of framework. Yeah, hopefully. And also, if you have risings within the whole entire sort of oil fields of the Middle East of workers there, possibly breaking away from the terrible oppressive feudal regime in Saudi Arabia, we can but hope for a more generalised sort of response. And I think with things like the internet and better communications and that these days, it is better to get our ideas as impossibilists, as our own little sort of tradition of as a revolutionary group, and our ideas across much more. Obviously there'll be all the Trotskyist ideas and whatever out there as well, but you can but hope, otherwise it's all hopeless and we might as well give up. which is the way I tend to look at it. But what I've been trying to do, moreover, is analyse the developments of, the working class in the area and base it on something a bit more concrete rather than just vague hopes. I leave that to you as to how I did and what you think about that. I don't know if there's anybody here who actually sort of supports any of the two-state solution or the kind of standard sort of national liberationist sort of point of view. I don't know what people know about that, because that was, I used to be a member of the SWP, and that's one of the things that put me off within short order was their attitude towards Islamic fundamentalism and their attitude towards the State of Israel. Like I say, I don't think the SWP is an openly anti-Semitic organisation. However, I think it has views and it supports people that could certainly give succour to, to an anti-Semitic perspective, basically anti-Judaic thought. Yeah.
Okay.
I thought you were
going to.
No, it was a
discussion. Well, I would say within the capitalist system, it's not on the way out. The two-state solution is the only way forward for that particular part of the world, because Israel's here to stay. there's no question of it folding up, and the Palestinian aspirations are here to stay. So within that context, and as I say, socialism is not on the cards either there or here. That's the only way forward. I mean, there's no other solution within the context of this type of society.
But the problem with that, Frank, is that it's two reasons. Firstly, a Palestinian state's just a no-go. It's completely unviable. What it's going to be is basically it's going to be a sort of state that, not unlike Bantustan was in apartheid South Africa, it's going to be a semi-autonomous political entity where basically a collaborationist ruling class who are collaborating with the ruling class on the other side basically do things like basic administration of the waterworks and, more importantly, the repressive sort of side of things, running the police forces and all the rest of it, whilst the rest of the population is basically condemned to be nothing but very, very, very cheap labour within Israel. It's a no-go for that. Secondly, of course, if you back a two-state solution, then you're implicitly backing both sections of the bourgeoisie. That, to me, isn't the socialist position. The socialist position is to back working-class self-emancipation, working-class organisation, to back the class struggle against the ruling class, be they Israeli, Palestinian, or whatever, on whatever level that takes. Palestinians aren't... they're not fortunate like people in Britain, that they don't live in a slightly more open democratic society. We don't yet get shot for expressing sort of dissenting views. They do. So, they've got to be careful. It would possibly mean that socialist groups would have to go underground or even, whatever. Or they might just may not be able to function whatsoever. Obviously, these are the same problems that our comrades in Zimbabwe have got at the moment.
Danny was next, Rob.
A couple of points that sort of bear up what you say. With the Israeli attacks on Arafat's headquarters, I think after listening to what you say, it could have been designed to get the Palestinian people, or those that think that they're Palestinians, to identify with Arafat rather than perhaps Hamas, to sort of give him some credence within. And when you mentioned the corruption, well, I remember watching a television programme on Palestine and the situation there. And apparently, according to this programme, Arafat's brother has got the concession to import cement, which is in high demand because everything's getting knocked down on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And he charges about 6 or 7 times what it costs him to import.
Yeah.
So they're making a fortune out of cement.
They're another grubby little bunch of capitalists with their fingers in the pies, really. And within the area, you do tend to get a lot of extended families taking over and sharing out. Look at Iraq. Saddam Hussein's cousin, his brother-in-law, his wife, his two brothers are the interior minister, the defence minister, the head of the state oil company, exactly like Kuwait or any other region. Which I don't want to preempt too much what Simon's going to say if he turns up, which I think he probably will, as he's giving the next talk. I hope he is, and I think that's some of what Simon's going to talk about in the next thing. But you are right, essentially. That's why I say the PLO are an embryonic ruling class. In fact, there's nothing embryonic about them anymore. Now they've set up this Palestinian Authority. So, we ought to be clear that there's no way we should give them any support in any way, shape or form whatsoever as socialists. They don't deserve it. They're the class enemy.
Sandy.
Thing about the two-state solution is still a difficult one, I think, because if you say that it's unviable, well, of course it depends what you regard as, depend on what you regard as the territory of a Palestinian state. I'm not an expert enough to kind of assess this from the point of view of economics, but according to the United Nations, Israel has a certain set of borders which it has gone beyond. Leaving aside the question of whether we can realistically expect this, if they were to retreat to those borders, how would a Palestinian state be then? And sort of bring up another point, how are Palestinian workers to... you can have trade union action, you can have various kinds of social action of various kinds, but without some kind of overarching political structure to work through, what are they going to do about expressing socialist consciousness? Apart from the obvious ways that you can express it spontaneously and just sort of do various things. Are they to be, as it were, excluded from the possibility of the use of the ballot box? Does it matter? And if it does matter, what's the answer to this?
Right.
Rather than just a generalised one that I've already sort of touched on.
Yeah. Okay, well, of course, yeah, you are right on the UN's perspective on this. Famously, I think it's Resolution 242, isn't it, which calls for the withdrawal of Israel to the pre-67 borders. Basically, that ain't going to happen. And I'll tell you why it ain't going to happen. That's basically been reversed within the actual technical agreements of the peace process, the Oslo Accords, and the various peace plans, in inverted commas, that were being put forward by Israeli governments throughout the 70s and 80s. They're based on the dispossession, the increasing dispossession of the occupied territories in Gaza and the West Bank. Basically, I mean, and again, I mean, I read this in Chomsky somewhere. He's written a big book on it called The Fateful Triangle. But a lot of the Oslo Accords actually give Israel legal rights over dispossessed land. So property rights, of a part of the occupied territories that these settlers have gone over are now inalienable. They're now protected by Israeli law and Israeli judge. If there's any kind of dispute about who owns what sort of water pipe or whatever, Israeli courts have the legitimate say on what goes there. You know, they have first dabs on it. They're going to say what goes. And, of course, they've got the overwhelming force within the area. You know, I mean, Israel's got absolutely overwhelming military force vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So if such rulings and whatever aren't actually listened to, they'll back them up in force. As I was saying, also infrastructurally, the territories have changed since 67. A lot of it is actually, and its resources are being integrated into Israel proper. For example, if you look at the Jerusalem area, another great sort of sticking point, but there are basically Israeli settlements now ringing East Jerusalem, the Arab and Christian Palestinian parts of the greater Jerusalem area. There's about 150,000 Israelis who now live within that greater Jerusalem area. You know, it's claimed as the indivisible sort of capital, and it's now a large urban sprawl which is going out, and all of that is, you know, being claimed by the Israelis. And that's something that it doesn't matter who you're talking to, be it Sharon or the most dovish member of the Israeli Labour Party, they're not going to want to get rid of that. And of course, up in the north around Galilee, as well as I already alluded to, a lot of the water supplies from the rivers up around there, from the source of the Jordan and whatever, are now being piped into, you know, northern Israeli agriculture proper. So to be honest, a lot of the prime land and that in the area is now already infrastructurally linked into Israel. I don't personally see that as ever being given up. There may be a few token small settlements that will be given up, but basically it'll be the ones that are more trouble than they're worth. Like there's a couple of hundred Zionists who have settled in Hebron, you know, one of the biggest Palestinian towns over there, literally right in the middle of it. There's 200 of them, there's about 150,000 Palestinians around them, and, you know, the Israeli army are always having to go in to protect them and all the rest of it, and all the attendant trouble and discontent that causes. So I think little settlements like that will be given up as a kind of token, but I think a lot of it will remain integrated, to be honest, Sandy. And that's the one point. So that's why I say is that, you know, it'll only ever be a kind of Bantustan style sort of statelet rather than a fully functioning nation state. And of course, you know, as Danny was saying, you know, that suits the needs of the PLO just fine, and the needs of the Palestinian Authority. They're just another, you know, corrupt little tin pot ruling class. You know, I don't think at the end of the day they'll care where the profits are rolling in from, you know, and who's ass they have to kiss basically to get them. I don't think they're that sort of nationalistically strong and proud anymore. As for the position that can be taken up by his Palestinian workers, again, it's a moot point, isn't it? Because, you know, I mean, we don't have any Palestinians that are members of our organisation, so therefore we can't get any first-hand sort of reports back from people. They're going to face, as I said earlier on, the same sort of trouble that our comrades in Zimbabwe have got. Personally, I think a lot of sort of working-class discontent, as you alluded to, is and will be expressed spontaneously in the area, and I know a lot of members of this party aren't going to want to hear that, but that is going to involve violence, unfortunately. I know the pacifists in the organisation won't like that. And I'm not for a minute advocating that people go out and throw stones at Israeli tanks. It's not big, it's not clever, and it's going to get yourself shot. But, you know, what else can they do? And if you do get some kind of elected form of the Palestinian Authority, then obviously you can start thinking about using the ballot box then. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think, it's going to be very, very, very difficult. And I think that's why we need a wider sort of movement and greater class consciousness, you know, not just in Israel, but in the West as well. And that basically, you know, our sort of dissonance and pointing out what's going on in places like Israel is going to help, obviously, as well. So it's a two-way thing. You know, it's as much up to workers in the West as it is as to workers who are operating and living in, you know, very, very difficult conditions within the West Bank. I mean, to be honest, I think a lot of working class people in Palestine have probably enough on their hands dodging Israeli curfews and getting enough to eat every day, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible that the Israelis might be getting away with stuff like the genocide
program? No, I don't think so. I don't.
But, I mean, is there a way that they can avoid them?
I don't think they'd create. I think genocide is a very overused term these days.
Do you think the Palestinians have any means to defend just some basic kind of.
Unfortunately, it's physical defence for a lot of it. To be honest, I mean, like, again, that pacifist in the organisation might not like that, but if I lived on the West Bank, fuck it, I'd have a gun, you know, to defend myself against the Islamic fundamentalists, against Fatah and against the Israeli military. Sorry. It's going to come down to that. However, you touched upon it, and I've heard people in the past, I don't know. It's dangerous sort of stuff. I wouldn't want to speculate. You've touched upon, you know, sort of saying the Israelis commit sort of genocide or whatever, or they might do. We had a visitor to Central London Branch where I did this discussion meeting. It was basically, you know, calling Israelis. Well, he actually wasn't calling Israelis. He was calling all Jews fascists. The Israelis do occupy a regime of colonial occupation in the occupied territories. Yes, you know, but it's not a fascist state. They're not engaging in ethnic cleansing, as you know, as in extermination. There's not an industrialised process of extermination that's going on there. All right, so I mean, and also given the context of you talking about, you know, Israelis, it's also pretty untactful, and really, to be honest, let's not beat about the bush there. You know, I mean, I know the Zionists use the Holocaust as a big ideological, you know, justification for the existence of the State of Israel. It's true, but there ain't nothing that's going to, you know, isolate a lot of Jewish Israelis more than if you start calling them fascists or whatever. So, I don't think it has any basis, and I think it's offensive, and I really don't think if you're engaging in sort of socialist propaganda and activity, you really ought to be sort of saying those kind of things.
Chiron's wanted in France as a war criminal.
Sorry?
Chiron's wanted in France as a criminal.
Yeah, very good. I mean, and yeah, I think he is a war criminal, you know. But then again, I mean, I think that, you know, many members of the international bourgeoisie are war criminals. You know, Henry Kissinger, for example, you know, it's a matter of who gets labelled that way. I don't think it's up to other states to extradite people and charge them for war trials either. I think that, you know, people get put on trial for being war criminals by the working class population of that area, not by, you know, some bunch of like liberals in Western Europe or whatever, basically, who are often just as compliant with other sort of terribly atrocious acts or whatever. Well, I mean, yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, you know, Blair and Bush and Clinton and all the rest of them are responsible for just as many deaths as Sharon by supporting in the ongoing sanctions against Iraq. You know, I mean, I think they should be put on trial for that. You know, so yeah, it's a difficult one, but you are right, yeah. I mean, Ariel Sharon is a particularly brutal and terrible politician, even by bourgeois standards, yeah.
Kenny.
When you lived in Israel, I was saying yes.
Briefly, mate, yeah.
Did you speak to Israelis about the settlements in the Palestinian territories?
Oh, yeah.
Did they see it as provocative or a natural progression of the growing Israeli state?
Sure.
And why do they think, what about Arafat? why do they think that the Israelis just don't go and assassinate them? Why do they keep them there? Can you speak to them? What do they think about that?
Okay.
Settlements and all right.
Well, firstly, I mean, I lived briefly for about 9 months in Israel in 1990 on a kibbutz. It was quite unusual in that it was actually a non-Zionist kibbutz. And I met people who were former members of the Communist Party, various peace groups, and so on and so forth. A lot of them, yeah, did see direct settlement in the occupied territories as wrong and as provocation, as you say. There have actually been small Israeli groups who actually try and go out and disrupt the building of these settlements, you know, and good on them. The main activity that we were really involved with there was sharing water with the local Palestinians. We were right by the border in 67, what was the border in 67, the Green Line. And we were always in trouble with the army because we used to share water with the local Palestinian farmers. You'd always get, you know, some bunch of these guys in uniforms coming in to try and, you know, harass us, break up our water pipes, whatever. So that sort of thing, and there was a lot of people sort of backing and hiding conscientious objectors and draft dodgers and things like that. But what I'm trying to say is, I think I had quite a skewed, you know, view of what the average Israeli kind of thought. To be honest, I didn't really talk to many people outside of the kibbutz. But it seemed to me that there's probably, I mean, especially amongst like the newer sort of sections of the Israeli population from the East of Europe, the more kind of religiously fanatical Americans that go over there, and some of the ones who are basically natural Likud supporters, people who've been kicked out since 47 from other Arab countries like Morocco and Algeria and Iraq and Iran, they tend to see it more, yeah, as a kind of legitimate thing. Although, I mean, it's very, very split. I mean, obviously, I guess if you ask 10 different Israelis, you get 10 different opinions about it. But like I say, the settlements are by the newer Israeli settlers. You see, there is this influx within Israel, and Israel's under massive economic pressure to give them land, to give them jobs, and they simply can't be contained or satisfied within the pre-67 borders of Israel. That's why, I mean, as I was saying in the talk, I think Israel is actually, you know, compelled to expand. You know, it's a capitalist nation, it's like any other. It's compelled to expand. It's just in the state of Israel, it's pretty obvious to see. Secondly, about Arafat, I don't know, they're talking about getting rid of Arafat now. You see, Arafat was always a big sort of demon figure. Right up until about the early 90s, you know, he was portrayed in Israel much the way that Saddam Hussein's being portrayed in the West at the moment. Do you know what I mean? And they kind of had to do a bit of an about face to reach some kind of settlement with the Palestinian Authority. I think what they're thinking now, because of Arafat's age, he's approaching 80, and his physical condition. I mean, if you see the man, he's basically obviously starting to suffer from dementia. I think he's getting very forgetful, he's getting shaky. The man's on his way out, and he's a convenient scapegoat, and always has been, by the Israeli right, by people like Sharon. You know, he's their big demon figure. So I think what they want is a compliant PA, much the same way that it's operating at the moment, but just with a different head. You know, much the same way that Britain and America want a tame Baathist regime in Iraq, just with a different figurehead dictator to provide stability, basically. So I don't think Israel is any longer protecting Arafat. Can
I just come in there? Right? I'm surprised, because my friend worked over in Israel, and he was in a kibbutz too, and he got friendly with Arabs, and he actually got deported from Israel.
Oh, right, okay.
So I don't know why. They just come in and smash your stuff up, did they?
They were trying to, yeah. I mean, you know.
You're not getting any warnings about your behaviour?
Not the kibbutz did in general, yeah. I mean, to be fair, you know, there are legal repercussions if the Israeli army does come in and smash up the kibbutz's private property, you know. So they've got to be careful on that way. Yeah, I imagine the headlines there'd be all over the world anyway, you know, if there was any kind of a hassle sort of there. But yeah, no, we did regularly get intimidated by the Israeli military. It being a conscript army, of course, some of the soldiers went in for it more than others. I can remember a couple of occasions where you just had young lads standing around looking embarrassed, not wanting to be there. So, I don't know.
Sandy.
Difficult thing.
Yeah. I was just going to sort of say that I think the point that they just made was
was trying to make isn't so much whether it was going on or not, but they would get away with it if they wanted.
Oh, right, okay.
And stuff like that. And but I think you're right, though, that, we remember the Lebanese council, whatever it was, the word, was it Sabra and Shakira? I think there was a bit of, there was perhaps a bit of a racial flavour to that one. But I think that many Israeli Jews would recoil quite a bit from any notion of genocide. Even somebody like Sharon, who's used the kind of terminology, and who I think was involved in that one anyway, and who's used the kind of terminology that you said, I think there's just, you know, it would have too many, it would risk upsetting too many people who have either got still memories of the Second World War or have the inheritance of that from their families. I mean, people who weren't there can still have nightmares about it. I've met people who have had nightmares about the things that have been told about it. So I think genocide is not the most likely option, quite apart from which it would probably, don't wish to sound too calculating, but it might be considered quite a wasteful thing anyway, you know, unless you're actually in serious competition with a group of people, you know, where they're fighting hard for resources that you want. This is, I think, where you tend to get genocide, although I do agree with what you said about it being a somewhat overused phrase, like fascism, you know, but I think that's the point. I don't think they're doing it on any kind of planned basis. I suppose they could get away with some if they wanted, but it wouldn't actually be very easy given the emotional, the psychological repercussions of something like that. And people who any regime who did it would have to rely on for support as well.
Can I just say it briefly? One thing. No, I don't think I actually meant the getting away with genocide. I suppose what I meant was that because they have this expansive state, they can actually do things like, well, say what they call pogrom. They can be rid of people in small ways and kind of cover it up. And just, in other words, Palestinians don't have any means of resisting against the development and everywhere they go. But they can do things, obviously, discreetly and kind of hiding it. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like people disappearing, but people don't even know them.
The Israeli state assassinates its opponents, and it's quite open about it. It doesn't even try and cover it up. You know, the other day, one of the leaders of Hamas in the Gaza Strip was assassinated. You know, I mean, they do it quite openly. And the way that they do it sometimes is to get an F-16 fighter bomb and to chuck bombs through people's doors. You know, they're not subtle about it at all. And another reason why Palestinian state is a no-go is it has no security whatsoever. You know, it's something, you know, whenever there's any kind of trouble, what do you get? You know, you get a column of Israeli tanks rumble into the middle of Bethlehem or into, you know, the refugee and transit camps in the Gaza Strip. You know, they've got overwhelming firepower and all the rest of it. So unless, you know, a Palestinian state, a Palestinian authority does exactly what the Israeli state wants all the time, it's in deep trouble, basically.
Okay.
I mean, the only way it can defend itself, obviously, is to, you know, start to appeal to, the Israeli working class there not to participate in the military and all the rest of it, ultimately, you know, unfortunately. Well, not unfortunately, because that's the way forward, I think, towards getting socialism in the area. So.
Right. At present, we've got three people in the audience who want to speak. I don't know what people think about calling it a day after that and then breaking for dinner.
5 minutes.
About 5 minutes.
About 5 minutes.
So, well, we've got sandwiches for you. Right, so it's Adam, Mike and Frank have got their hands up, so Adam first.
No, I was going to say that Israel poses not a problem, typically, because we were set up in 1994, and Israel was established in 1947, in historical time, and we were arguing all right from 1904 with Zionists, saying that's not a solution, that's not the way to go. So in fact, our position logically is that Israel should never have been set up in the first place. It was a huge, you know, it was a huge mistake. And similarly, I mean, even now we must say to people of Jewish origin, you shouldn't emigrate to Israel. You should stay where you are, integrate and assimilate, and become part of the general world. The trouble is, if you go around saying Israel was a mistake, you should never be set up, you lay yourself open to a sort of challenge that you're, you know, every other nation can have its nationalism. Why just pick on Israel? But it is an historical anomaly, Israel. I mean, that's no other state has been established under the, you know, under those sort of circumstances. I mean, in fact, you know, contrary to what you said, if I was in that area, I know what I would do. Get out. I'd emigrate to America, I'd emigrate to Australia, I'd emigrate to South Africa. I just leave it. You know.
The point that needs to be made for that, Adam, is that you know, Israel has been around since 48 now. For some people within Israel, that's not an option. You know, they are Israelis, they're born there, and they might not want to leave. You know, they've got family there and all the rest of it, you know. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you are right, you know, Israel is a historical anomaly, but, you know, it's there now, and it's been there since 48, and you've got to deal with the situation on the ground rather than what we would have liked to have happened, you know, way back when. I mean, you are right. I mean, I know, and the part of the problem is that the reason why Israel has gone so right-wing in the last 10 to 15 years is because a lot of people with progressive leftist and sort of socialist views have to leave Israel because, you know, they don't want to serve in the military. They can't put up with the situation in that society, you know, the way that it is. It has all sorts of problems there, particularly if you're, you know, at all secularly inclined. You know, that a lot of like responsibility for education and marriage and religious law is given over to Orthodox Jewish groups, and so therefore if you're not an Orthodox Jew, you know, let alone anything else, you know, there are certain things that become difficult and unpleasant when you live in Israel. So, you know, I mean a lot of people are, you know, going out, leaving Israel, but unfortunately, you know, also, so like I say, you know, A, Israel already exists, and B, what is that doing to the complexion of Israeli society? I would suggest that an exodus of, you know, kind of progressives and leftists and whatever is impoverishing Israel and it's pushing it to the right.
Okay, Mike.
You mentioned about the Israeli economy having declined since 20 odd years ago.
Mm.
Does that mean then that the established settlements in the West Bank, economically, they will be affected by the amounts of sums of money that the state has available to actually fund them, to sustain them? Because if they're uneconomically viable for themselves, I mean, first of all, I'd like to know what is it